Hey, welcome to Swine Time Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Wayne. I'm one of the veterinarians here at Pipestone. I'm also one of the owners in Pipestone Holdings, and I have one of my partners here today and also a friend and somebody I've asked to come and speak about stuff. It's John DeYoung. I'll let John introduce himself a little bit better.
My name's John DeYoung. I'm a nutritionist and lead our nutrition team today here at Pipestone. I've been with Pipestone for a little over 7 years and currently reside in Northwest Iowa. Just moved back to my hometown of Orange City, so that's been fun. And
you said a lot of things there, but what do you actually do? What would you say you do here?
Don't ask that question. My wife asks me quite a bit what I'm doing during the day. I spend, you know, a good chunk of my time running our business, which is kind of multifaceted. We've got nutritionists and we're a formulation company. And then we've also got a procurement company. And so we do quite a bit of ingredient procurement for folks. And then we've just recently started a little bit of meal management. And so spend some time on that as well. So spend my time kind of between those three areas for the most part.
Okay.
And then every once in a while, I actually get to be a nutritionist, but, slowly and surely my smart folks are taking away my keys to all the stuff to do.
They don't let you mess with
formula. They don't let me mess with formula. Yeah.
What is it? Normally it was grow finish pigs or sows or what?
Yeah, grow finish for the most part. Kia really does all of our sows, Kia Berg. But they're slowly taking the keys away. So I hardly do any formulation, which for all the producers is really a good thing for them. So,
okay. So we have no real defined topic today. And as you're talking, I'm thinking, well, we're going to ask John. I could ask John a ton of stuff and he'd have pretty neat answers. One thing that I just thought of there is, you know, we've got these different nutritionists and Kia in our group, Kia Berg does the sow nutrition. How specialized is that? If you went to our group or any other feed company, are you equally skilled in sows and grow finish, or do you really specialize as you get into it?
That's a good question. You know, I think we've got some team members that moonlight back and forth between sows and grow finish, but you know, for the most part, we try to dedicate time there, you know, even for our internal sows that we manage and then do the nutrition for. I think it's pretty key that we've got folks that are dedicated not only to, you know, putting the formulas together, but the support, right? When somebody sees something on a farm or, you know, they're having an issue, I want them to have a point person that they can reach out to. And so today that's Kia and Maddie. Really, they do all of our sows. And then we've got a team dedicated to the wean to finish side. But I think it's for us, we try to separate those two because I think it's just good for those folks to have a point person on either side. But
So I'm thinking about sows and genetics changes over time in pigs. With pigs, I know even internal just to our company, we can study that. Like, oh, put this genetics and do trials with different diets and dial in protein levels and different ingredients. And everybody's doing that. Sow nutrition studies got to be way less common in the field. And yes. Who's doing that? Where are you even?
Super uncommon. There's not, the universities do it as best they can. But just imagine a university farm that has its limitations. You know, they might have 200 sows. And so to get a trial that has any number of sows and it is very difficult. So don't fault universities. They try really hard. But sow research is difficult for them to do just because of replication. So, you know, there's probably, if you were to go to a scientific meeting and go sit in the room where all the smart people talk about sow research, you know, there's like maybe 5 or 6, 7 different companies in the US, most of them integrator types that have, you know, just invested in sow research. And so, you know, on our own side, we've just recently invested quite a bit of funds into setting up lactation research. And so we've got a farm here around Pipestone now that's got research capacity. So either 2 or 4 farrowing rooms, I can't remember, but I think 4 farrowing rooms have an automated feeder that sits above each crate.
Like a Gestall feeder or something?
Yeah, it's a Gestall feeder. And then it's different than their commercial line where these feeders have the ability to blend. So you can run 2 feed lines to it and then it can blend those 2 feed lines together so you can feed different diets.
Yeah. Okay. And then you just litter by litter, you can look at different
zones, like lean weight and whatever. I think those farrowing rooms are 56 crates. And so we got 4 of them. So it doesn't take very long and you've got, you know, a couple hundred sows per treatment. And so that just started this year. And so they're doing their first trial right now. Still takes a while. It's going to take us probably 6 or 7 months to complete the first trial, but it's a necessary investment, right? We do a lot of large scale, gestation work, a lot of production work. It's very difficult to do nutritional studies on gestation. We've done some where you can top dress and try to do our best to get good data, but to get big numbers and to have high confidence in it, you really need a lot of numbers. You know, these, you go to these scientific meetings and I try not to get lost in it, but you know, someone puts up a data set and there's only 30 sows and there's like five guys or gals in the back of the room that instantly raise their hand and start, you know, that's not enough sows to make a good decision. It's probably, there's some truth to that. So we try to make sure, you know, with Francisco and Kia, those two do a ton of work and really some research that's not getting done other places. That's really, really cool.
Yeah. So I'm not smart enough to be a nutritionist or even think about the stuff that you've forgotten, but when I go to a farm and I look at the sow herds, the things I would say that commonly come up, prolapses and lameness in sows. And then I send bones in and think, oh, wow, what do these bones look like? Oh, they've got some evidence of like metabolic bone disease would be not uncommon to find on even normal producing herds if you just send in some bones. So I'm wondering, both those things, people start pointing fingers at nutrition. It's like, why can't you fix my problem? Is there any, you have any thoughts on that as far as either what research could be done, what things we know, what it seems like there would be a nutritional piece to that, or maybe it's a small part. I don't know.
Well, I was on the don't ask list, Spencer. So you kind of broke the first, I thought we wrote that down earlier, but
our predefined agreement of what we talked.
I signed a contract, man. The metabolic bone thing. And I agree. You see the diagnostic reports when you get them in there. And it's like, I'm pretty certain that if you sent bones from anywhere to a diagnostic lab today, that there's like a 90% chance it's going to come back with some kind of metabolic bone disease.
Yeah.
That's probably not true. I just made the number up, but it does seem like a lot of pigs come back with that.
It's more than half.
High performing pigs, super high performing herds.
Yeah.
And so you just look at the herd in general and say, does it matter? I'm not sure, but you know, what are we doing on our end? Lot of work, right? And so I think it goes back to knowing your vitamin and mineral levels. And really that some of that stuff starts really early in those gilt's life, right? Mm-hmm. Probably back in utero, some of those things are already occurring.
For bone growth.
I think if you talk to some of the folks up at University of Minnesota, they would say like, you know, that occurs already in utero, some of those things.
Yeah.
And so we see it in the finishing and we're talking about stuff that happened 7-8 months ago, but you know, the vitamin research work, it's tough, super expensive. A lot of the, nutritionists are going to tell you, hey, this is the NRC level, which is the, kind of this agreed upon level of what we're supposed to have in the feed. But in all honesty, those numbers were created probably a long time ago, right? You know, some of the actual trial work that those numbers are based off of are back in the 70s or 80s, right? So what do? We just take that number and like take it times five and feed five times what the NRC tells us to feed. And honestly, my team, you know, we're going to feed more, right? We're never going to feed less. We're always going to feed more. And if it just gets the vets off our back for a little while, we'll continue to do it. But I think there's work that needs to be done there. It's very difficult work to do. It's very expensive. And then who pays for it, right?
The NRC numbers, they don't change. I always thought there was some NRC committee saying, oh, the new 2023 NRC value for this is.
Yeah, it doesn't come out very often. So there's like a 2012 version, and I think it came out again in 2018. And there's a lot of folks that don't think another version will ever get made. So
really?
Just.
The animal's got to be a lot different. It has to be it's consuming so much more because the pace is so much faster.
Yeah, for sure. And so I think, you know, we definitely make sure there's margin of error. You know, we're going to lean on the high side and then really let the pigs tell us, right? And so, yeah, maybe there's signs of metabolic bone disease, but like, what is the pig telling us? He's a high, super high performing pig, super high performing herd. You know, do we really have an issue if we're, you know, weaning 32 pigs per sow per year?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd be hard pressed to. You'd be hard pressed to convince me that farm has a problem when there's farms down the road that wean 25 and
this is,
but the vitamin D status is great, you know?
Yeah. But this is amazing though. I had a case where I thought there was some issue with low blood sugar in sows. It was related to Mycoplasma suis and I'd seen it a few times and I was trying to figure out a way to diagnose. And so I was taking blood glucose measurements in sows and we're thinking, oh, these sows are super low and low enough that you and I would be in the hospital probably with the blood glucose levels that low. Then I went to normal farms. It was the same. And then I looked at the NRC or not NRC. I looked at the published values from labs on what it should be. I was like, well, they're given like human values. Maybe it was 50 years ago. I don't know. But the sow today can function well with like marginal to low blood sugar levels. And the same with iron. Or hemoglobin?
Iron, vitamin D levels and serum, you know, and those things are very complicated, right? We take serum levels for a lot of stuff because it's easy, right? You're at the farm, you can bleed. I can get blood tubes very quickly because I don't have to kill an animal or euthanize an animal. I can send those off for diagnostics, right? Well, the problem with serum samples is what if that pig didn't eat feed for 24 hours? Well, the serum levels change. That's regulated inside the body, right? Yeah. So if that pig's not eating, his or her serum levels are going to be off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what pigs do we usually take diagnostics on? The pigs that are off feed, in the sick pen, downers, you know, those types of pigs that probably haven't been to the feeder. They aren't high intake animals anyways. And so, but they've got this problem. Well, they haven't been eating feed for a week. And so we look at some stuff and say, yeah, they're deficient.
Yeah.
Well, take a healthy pig. Is that pig deficient? No, probably not. But it's confusing. I get it. It's hard to find those answers. And I think there's lots of those things where they're so multifaceted. You know, just go down the list, like prolapses, hemorrhagic bowel, HBS. And you know how many times people say, we've got HBS. And it's like, yeah, I picked 10 different things that might fix it. And none of them are really that related.
Yeah.
We have ulcers. Okay, great. Not great, but there's so many different things that can affect some of those, like, you know, they're just these big buckets. I feel like we throw pigs into, oh, I've got a prolapse issue. I've got an HBS issue. I've got an ulcer issue. All are terrible. And I want to help you, but it's really difficult when there's 10 or 15 different things that might cause those, you know, you start going down the list. We had an advisory panel last week. And so we were talking about ulcers and, you know, a lot of smart people in that room. We got people from the university and people from large integrators that come in and, you know, help us, right? There's some super smart guys, guy from Europe that thinks way differently than anyone else. And I say, okay, what can cause an ulcer? Just start listing, guys. And it's like, you get to like number 12 or 13 and some of them are nutritional. Some of them are environment. Some of them are genetic. Some of them are health. You know, it's just like, there's 10 different things that can cause one problem. Yeah. How do you figure out what it is?
Yeah. So you're basically, for the listening audience, we offer no solutions. We offer only increased confusion, but it is a little bit like the more you learn, the deeper into you get, the more you realize how much you don't know that's out there. It's not simple. It's usually very complicated. And I would say that's almost everything in pig production is multifactorial for any problem.
And I think there's a time to really, you know, there are specific things that can cause stuff and we really need to do, you know, I think we as Pipestone Vet Service or Pipestone Nutrition, we do our job, right? We try to do our best to really dial in, okay, what is the true cause? Let's cross the things off the list and get down to the 1 out of 10 things that is causing this. But it's also difficult, right? It's not easy. It's not a fast process. It takes trial and error to go back and forth and figure those things out. Yeah. And I think, you know, even for our own team, I think you and I have a similar personality where, like, you know, I like to chase unicorns every once in a while, right? It's like, oh, I got this weird thing that's happening. And so I go on a, you know, just big push for a month to try to figure something out when it's like, you know, maybe we just need to focus on the block and tackle things, right? Let's do the simple things, get the feeder set right, get feed in front of pigs, make sure vaccines are getting into the pig, you know, simple stuff that really affects production. And I think it's good for that reminder, even when you get to the producers that, you know, I work with, just try to remind them like, hey, can we do these 5 things, right? If we do those 5 things, okay, perfect. We can cross those off the list. And then we can start chasing those smaller things, right?
Yeah. And it's like, we're talking about these, oh, here's a problem. Here's the cause. Here's the solution for the, you know, and it's the most frustrating, but enlightening and maybe uplifting thing at the same time is sometimes you just put a better person there to do the job every day and everything gets better. And you think, really, it was just Fred. That was it. He was the problem. It's like the people aspect.
Yeah.
It blows everything out of the water. If you just get somebody that checks the ventilation every day and does the things, like, oh, I guess I don't have as big of a problem. When somebody's actually just doing the job every day, that counts for a lot. And we don't even give it that credit half the time.
Yeah, I think I always say to folks, I'd much rather take a great caretaker in a terrible barn versus a brand new barn and a terrible caretaker. And we try to work with all, and we want to make all better. A great caretaker can cover up, you know, a lot of sins.
Yeah. Anyway, we're drifting off of a topic we didn't even say we had. So I wanted to ask you about, I asked you a little bit beforehand, but feed delivery. Because we were talking before and you say, oh, yeah, you know, what was it before? You had like a Smidley feeder or some kind of prior to the farm, wooden side. It looks like a old grain gravity box or something like that.
They had those old wooden feeders. And I can remember at the young farm, I guess maybe we had the part of the farms. Those were those upright steel feeders with the, you know, 10 holes in the bottom and they had those lids. And I can remember laying there at night, you know, in the summer with window open, cause we didn't have air conditioning and
you're the clanking, that,
you know?
Yeah.
You knew the pigs were eating.
Yeah. So go from that to,
so yeah, we had that, right. And most guys were grinding and mixing feed at their house, right? Probably had a vertical mixer of some sort that they got to concentrate from, you know, some feed company or co-op maybe down the road. And that was a great deal. And So yeah, then we, you know, moved forward a little bit and guys started building confinements, right? That was the big, you know, we talked about the Murphy setup and yeah. You know, so we started building confinement, you know, or enclosed indoor hog production, I guess, whatever the politically correct way to say that is. But yeah, so then you went from those Smidleys, they're the pride of the farms, whatever they were. And then I think tube feeders, right? That was like this big revelation, is these tube feeders and run a tube down, little agitator at the bottom. And really those were, I think, technically based off probably those old Osbornes, if you remember the mm-hmm. Osbornes, right?
Yeah, with the spinner.
With the spinner on the bottom. And that's mm-hmm. all a tube feeder is, just smaller and less capacity. I don't know how we thought that was a good idea, but we put tube feeders everywhere, mm-hmm. probably in the 90s, I would say.
Yeah, every barn had tube feeders. And now, very well, they're still out there, but nobody's putting new tube feeders in, I would say it's pretty fair.
Definitely don't see new ones, and you see a lot of them sitting in groves.
Yeah, you can judge the industry by what's in the grove.
Yeah. First you saw the upright mixer and then you see the tube feeders. And I think the next was the big, you know, dry feeder, right? Large capacity, rarely runs. And really, those tube feeders were good, right? I mean, super efficient from a feed utilization standpoint. Best feed efficiencies I see in general are going to be on pigs that are on tubes. Now it probably means we're somehow limit feeding those animals and restricting growth potentially, but you know, best feed efficiency for sure on a tube feeder. Then we went to dry feeders, you know, those pigs have 300-400 pounds of access to feed. So it's, you know, it's a lot more difficult to run those pigs out of feed. Mm-hmm. Probably gave up some feed conversion, but picked up a little bit of gain maybe compared to a tube, maybe not necessarily, I think. But yeah, so we had dry feeders, you know, I think all through early 2000s. You still see a lot of those go in, right? They're high capacity. They're easy to manage, easy to set. You know, it's kind of the infomercial, set them and forget them, right? You just kind of set those dry feeders and walk away. But yeah, you know, really, I don't know when they started to come out, but the wet dry feeders, really the next revolution, right, of feeders. It's been,
that came about 15 years ago, that became increasingly popular, Crystal Springs feeder. And then everybody kind of made a copy of that, it seemed like, afterward. That's at least what I remember. I might be wrong.
Yeah, I don't know which one came first.
But yeah, so wet dries, it seems like mostly what's going in now.
Yeah, you see a ton of wet dries going in, and that really, what's the benefit of a wet dry feeder? Well, it promotes average daily gain, really promotes feed intake and you know, whatever it is, that mechanism, most likely having the water access so close and making some kind of gruel-ish type feed. Drives intake.
A lot less water waste.
Drives average daily gain. Yeah, fewer gallons of water used, which is great from a sustainability standpoint, and makes your manure, you know, more concentrated, so that manure is higher value. You have less, you know, less volume, less gallons to pump, which that saves money. Maybe similar feed conversion, maybe slightly worse if you're not. I think they're a harder feeder to manage in the field. You know, it does seem, especially on like nursery diets, and if you're feeding pellets, you know, it definitely feels like feeder management maybe is a little bit harder on the wet dry feeder for guys or gals in the barn. But if you have a good person managing them, I do think feed conversion's roughly the same. Interesting enough, those carcasses on those pigs are typically a little bit, you know, fatter.
But yeah. Wonder where that would be. The intake's higher. Who knows? So when I go and if I look at a new barn being built, it's just a wet dry. It's like that hasn't changed in way more than 5 years that I can, I would say 5-10 years, where the wet dry is the same wet dry, essentially, except for the lift mechanism might be a little, you know, cooler looking or something on it. But What's next? Is there anything next that you could say you see in Europe or you see somewhere else?
Yeah, I think it's always interesting to look at other countries, right? Because I think we're pretty quick in at least the U.S. to say, oh, we're the best at it, right? And I don't totally disagree with that, but I think it's always good to know what your neighbors are doing. And so you look at Europe, you see, and they've been doing it for a long time, but a lot of liquid feeding, right? A lot of Big Dutchman, or there's other delivery systems, but a lot of liquid feeding, which is always interesting. And then you look at kind of their grain product mix, right? They just don't feed a ton of corn, and I don't think we'll ever get away from that in the U.S. just because corn is here, right? Corn is king. But you see a lot of small grains, very similar to maybe a Canadian diet, barley, rye, wheat, those type of things. And there's definitely differences, right, in feeding sows or grow finished pigs with small grains versus other stuff. So yeah, I think in Europe, back to the feeders, you know, you see a lot of liquid feeding. You know, maybe South America, warmer countries, Mexico, South America. You know, you see a lot of wet dry feeders, but a lot of pelleted diets. And I think just to promote intake when it's hot out, you know, they're trying to get those pigs to eat quickly. They can get a lot of nutrients consumed by eating quickly. And one interesting thing I think, you know, that we've just started to look at in South America on these wet dry feeders, you know, they might push 16, 17, up to 18 pigs per hole. In the US on a wet dry, you know, you maybe have 13, 14, maybe 15. I think people get nervous when you start putting 15 pigs per hole on a feeder. And so what do they know in South America that we don't? Well, they feed in pelleted diets, so those pigs can consume feed faster because it's, you know, compact. But they have crazy feed conversions, right? One, because of the pelleting, they do feed a little bit more fat. But I also think because you increase the number of pigs on those feeder holes, you get better feed conversion. There's a little more competition maybe for that feed. So We're looking at it. I know Francisco and the research team, they're gearing up to try to do a trial with a sponsor to try to figure that out. But
so that you bring up something interesting, because when I first went out in practice, I saw a lot of pelleted feed. And it was really crummy pellets, like literally crummy. They would turn into crumbs. It was not high density pellets. It wasn't like making rabbit alfalfa pellets or something that are super hard like dice. These would fall apart pretty easy. How much would you influence a pig's intake by the quality of the pellet? Is that a big deal?
I don't know if you influence intake.
What would you influence? The quality of the pellet. What is
it? Yeah, it really affects feed conversion. And so I don't know. I should know if that's intake driven or if it's gain driven. But basically what we see is if you go to 0% fines, you're going to get this really nice feed efficiency response to feeding pellets. That starch is gelatinized. We think that's better for the pig, but as those pellets get worse, and when I say worse, you know, whatever the percentage of the total product that's fines versus pellets. So as that percentage of fines goes up, you know, really we think the break-even point is up at like 50 to 60% of fines. So if 50 to 60% of the diet is fines versus pellet, basically all that feed efficiency response, it's eroded. It goes away. So then there's, you know, just imagine some curve in between 0 and 60. If you get a 6% response to feed efficiency at 0% fines and a 0% response at 60% fines, you know, you just kind of follow your line back.
So that would say that the fines represent some amount of gelatinization that occurred, some conversion of that.
Yeah, potentially if that feed's not, you know, gelatinized well enough, doesn't hold together. But I don't think it's totally driven by that. I think it's, you know, if they sort, they like to go consume those pellets and then they sort the fines out. Mm. You know, I think that's where guys get, you know, a lot of complaints in the field. They just sort fines that to the side,
sense.
Right?
That can make sense, especially if it was just getting nosed out or something and it was sorting through it.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, we've burned up a lot of time here. I just got the signal. We're at 22 minutes and we had no defined topic, except I knew you probably had some interesting things to say. I think that was true. Yeah, good stuff.
Hopefully.
Hey, appreciate you being on, John. We'll have to have you on again with a different topic, but that relates to your expertise sometime in the future.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks for being here. Swine Time Podcast was created for the pork industry and individual pork producers around the country. Hosted by me, Dr. Spencer Wayne, with the Pipestone Veterinary Services. The podcast contains pork industry news, advancements in animal care, and how to enhance your productivity. Monthly podcasts are available on Spotify, Google Music, iTunes, Anchor, and on www.pipestone.com.